traditionally invested more in B2B marketplaces and distribution plays, which we'll continue to do. But now we are increasingly seeing more opportunities in the production side of B2B. So A, building a very strong L-1 team with high integrity and capability. And then B, managing a very large sales force on the field team using tech and ensuring their productivity. So in most companies, right, the places where we have seen things break are more on the balance sheet side of things and not the P&L side of things. So if you have high moats, the margins become defendable. And if you have very strong ROCE, then you start generating cash out of it. Corporate governance starts at the mind of the founder.
We will be discussing about the opportunity for B2B in 2023 and beyond. Hello everyone and welcome to Matrix Moments. I am Anurag and I am part of the B2B Investments team. Today we will be discussing about the opportunity for B2B in 2023 and beyond. Does it still continue to excite us as exciting as it was a couple of years back? What are some of the key fundamentals that a good B2B business need to have to kind of make it big? What are some of the pitfalls that founders should be aware of, especially in their 10 to infinity journey? And finally, to wrap up, we'll wrap it up with certain thoughts on which sectors, which trends in B2B are things that we are most excited about. Today with me, I have Sudipto, who leads a B2B and deep tech investments. He has very closely followed the space for the last 7+ years and have invested in companies like WeGrow, Captain Fresh, Farmart, Business, among others. Welcome, Sudipto.
Thanks, Anurag. First of all, welcome to the B2B team at Matrix. As you know, right, we are big believers of B2B in India. And when we say B2B, it's across core manufacturing, agriculture, exports, logistics, supply chain and distribution businesses. Anything that's real GDP and sort of enables the core sectors in India to either produce more efficiently for India or for the world, that's B2B for us. And we've been big believers of this sector right from 2015-16 and have been fortunate to invest in more than 10 companies, including companies like Off Business, which is the largest company in B2B in the country, and multiple other category leaders, which you just mentioned about. So yes, super bullish and great to be doing the B2B marketplaces podcast again after 18 months.
Perfect. So clearly we are big believers in the B2B space and we have actually put our money where our mouth is. So our intentions can't be doubted out here. In fact, I remember you and Nitisha doing a bunch of series of podcasts last year wherein on why that was the correct time to build B2B. So there were multiple tailwinds that were present at that time. So the whole internet penetration due to Jio revolution, GST, Demo, UPI leading to MSME digitization and formalization in that economy. The whole China plus one global shift which happened, the push from government for manufacturing sector, PLIs, etc., which actually gave a lot of impetus to the Indian manufacturing sector. However, things have substantially changed from that time around. And they have taken a turn for the worse, so to speak. There are weakening macroeconomic global conditions. There are mass layoffs across industries, across geographies that we see. There are corporate governance issues which have started coming up now. So with all of these headwinds, how do you actually look at B2B today? Are you still as bullish? Has something changed in our world, in our point of view? How do things stand today?
First of all, great question. And I get asked this question a lot on has our stance in B2B changed? Actually, we are actually more bullish today on B2B than we were 18 months back. All the things that you said are actually true, and I'll address most of the questions that you raised. But an overall macro point, we are still continue to be very bullish on B2B. So now let's take your question and break it into three parts, right? First is on the macro. And 18 months back, we spoke about a bunch of macro tailwinds, digitization, formalization, China plus one, Make in India government push. All of them are still true. Actually, in certain cases, some of these tailwinds have accelerated. If I look at the last 18 months, there is more digital penetration today than it was in 2021. There is more formalization, more digital payments, better logistics infrastructure today, ONDC coming up, which was not there in 2021. If I talk about government push and incentives, in the last 12 months, there has been significant push on PLIs and DLIs for core manufacturing sectors. And multiple companies across EVs, auto, electronics manufacturing, ODMs, semiconductor fabless design companies, they've all gotten significant government push, funding and incentives. And the China plus one story, as we all know, actually is continuing to grow deeper and deeper, where everyone in the West across sectors are looking for supply chain partners outside of China, and India is definitely emerging as a geography from where they want to import goods from. So if I look at macro, actually over the last 18 months, the macro for Indian companies for B2B has improved. So that's one, right? Second, if I look at our portfolio companies, over the last 18 months, there is a economic slowdown in terms of funding, valuation, etc. But if I look at real numbers under the hood, companies have continued to execute and grow faster, and they have navigated themselves towards profitability. So if I look at companies like Off Business, they do tens of millions of dollars of PAT every month. There are companies like Zipmat, Farmart, which are EBITDA profitable. There are companies like VGrow and Captain Fresh, which have not only grown, but significantly expanded their take rates and contribution margins, where today their take rates are above 20%, contribution margins are closer to double digits. So overall, both in terms of growth and profitability, at least what we see from our portfolio companies, they have executed really well. Then third, you spoke about obviously a funding winter, corporate governance, and a lot of noise in the ecosystem. I think those statements are true. I think over the past 18, 20 months, there were a lot of companies that got funded, which did not add a lot of value, or there were corporate governance issues, which as we go through a bear cycle, there will be natural course of action taken. Some companies will survive, some companies will pivot to profitability. But overall as an ecosystem, I think we are in a much better place. And if I look 10 years out, I think the overall trend line and thesis that significant value will be created in core GDP sectors in India, that continues to be true. And I know I've told you this before, we are a country of the Tatas, the Ambanis, the Adanis, which are all in some shape and form core B2B companies, either actually doing the manufacturing or solving for distribution or some shape and form. So continue to be super bullish.
Got it. That's good to hear. And actually it plays out in the numbers that we see in the macroeconomy as well, right? Despite all the headwinds and everything, we still see a 5.1% growth year on year in the India's industry index of production, which is a direct indicator of how growth and factory output is happening. So I think that's a very clear indicator. And in fact, this is something which we have also seen across multiple downturn cycles as we go, right? That macros actually put pressure on key operating metrics. And it's only the companies which have strong fundamentals who survive through them. And they not just survive, they actually expand to take up the place which has been vacated by companies which probably didn't have those strong fundamentals which were out there. But that begs the question, in this current environment, and with B2B as a very specific example, what are those current fundamentals? What are those key characteristics that would enable a B2B company to actually become big, to have that big opportunity in such a scenario going forward?
Got it. See, the fundamentals have not changed. Whatever the fundamentals were 18 months back, it's still the same. So if you remember in the last set of podcasts that we did in B2B marketplaces, we identified 3-4 different things. One, if you're building in B2B, please build vertical B2B marketplaces, because every supply chain in B2B is different. So that's one, and it still continues to be true. Second, we spoke about the supply fragmentation. So if supply is fragmented and unbranded, then marketplace has all the value, because the buyer does not know if they can trust the supplier, and they start trusting the marketplace creates value. So if you're building a B2B marketplace company, please build in areas where the supply is fragmented. However, in areas where the supply is consolidated, branded, and there is a sort of IP in the production process, there you should build a core manufacturing or a core agri-tech company instead of building a distribution company. So figure out where the value is in the supply chain. Fragmented supply, value is with the marketplace. IP-driven consolidated supply, value is in the production. And focus on the right place to build for a particular supply chain. Third, B2B is as much a balance sheet company as a P&L company. So ensuring you are raising, having a strong balance sheet, raising debt, your cost of capital is cheaper, and ensuring that you have a tight monitoring sort of processes to ensure that collections, receivables, working capital days are under control is extremely critical. I would say those were key to building a B2B company 18 months back. They still continue to be the key to building a good B2B company. Take a vertical, figure out across the supply chain, where do you want to play, in production or in distribution. Then have a very strong balance sheet with low cost of capital and extremely strong collection and receivable processes. If you do that, it's a strong, solid B2B company, right? Now, let me take a step back and And instead of just talking about features and characteristics, like, let's talk about what's a great business. In the end, a great business is a business that has moat or defensibility, generates very high ROCE, which is return on capital employed, and throws out a lot of cash. So even like all these characteristics are so that you can build a business with an end state where you have a strong moat, you have high quality ROCE, and you start throwing a lot of cash. And that's the goal that founders should think about, that when they're building, in the end state, will these three things be true or not?
Got it. That's actually a very interesting point, because the general perception in the industry is that B2B doesn't have either of these three. There is no real moat in the B2B industry. Margins are wafer thin. Working capital is something which is probably best left undiscussed and unsaid out there. And that's the general perception. So maybe it's worthwhile going deep into each one of these to understand some of these better. Maybe let's start with moats. What, according to you, are key moats in the B2B industry that founders can actually look to build upon on and carry on from there?
Got it. Sure. I think typically when you look at B2B supply chains, right, if you are doing, say, commoditized manufacturing, you are producing kurtis that 1,000 other factories are doing, you actually don't have moats. Or you are doing a trading business where you are taking a commodity from 10 sellers and selling it to 15 buyers. You don't have a moat, because you can have another kurti factory the next day and you will be relevant, and you can have another trading partner that which flourishes the next day, and you start becoming relevant. That is why you don't have moats, which actually shows in ROCE and cash flows, which we'll talk about later. And that's what most people talk about. But fundamentally, if I take a step back and think about moats and defensibilities, across the B2B supply chain, there are a lot of areas where you can create true moats. Let me give you a few examples, right? Maybe the first thing that comes to my mind is, if you are building a marketplace with a lot of fragmented supply and a lot of fragmented demand, your ability to sort of map and match and take the right product from supply to demand is itself a moat. So that is matchmaking moat. And in any company, whether in any marketplace, whether a lot of SKUs, fragmented supply, fragmented demand, the underlying marketplace actually figures out which product to show to which buyer and then sell it to that buyer. So that's one moat. Second, in perishable supply chains with a lot of wastage and dump, ability to manage a supply chain where you procure at scale, then you grade different products, then you figure out the right buyer for a particular grade of product, and then transport it efficiently with logistics, is a moat where you can reduce, in an industry where wastage is 20-25%, you can bring it below 5% and you create economic value. Third, in say commodities, steel, agri, etc., the moat is actually in ability to underwrite your customer and expand outside of your core geography. It's very easy to do trading in your own geography where you know the end customer, which is why you underwrite because of relationship. But to build a pan-India network where you can underwrite hundreds and thousands of SMEs and have a low cost of capital because of a strong balance sheet is a moat. Fourth moat is, if you are taking Indian products to the world, you go to the West, you go to US, you go to Europe, they want to do China plus one, but they don't have a trusted brand out of India. You build a brand, trusted brand out of India by consistently delivering good quality products on time, again and again and again. And 3-4 years down the line, that consistency becomes brand, and the brand is a moat. And probably fifth, the final one, is just in core IP in manufacturing or agriculture. You create a process of producing good quality products either on the farm or on the factory that's proprietary to you. And you create, because of that, you are able to create an end product which is significantly different from the rest of the market. And you have that capability. That's a moat, right? And these are 4 or 5 on the top of my head. So there are multiple different moats. But you have to take a step back, and while building the company, think harder on, am I building capabilities in the company today that differentiates me from the rest of the competition? And no amount of capital or a new company can displace those capabilities built. And you know, we spoke about a lot about the macro tailwinds factors. The reason all of that is important is because those moats are possible to be built today because of those tailwinds. Because of digitization and so many SMEs adopting tech, you can create a marketplace with lot of supply, lot of demand, create liquidity. Because of China plus one, you can go to the West and create a brand for India. Because of digital penetration, you can do credit. Because of the PLI schemes and significant push from the government on core sectors in India, you can do innovation in manufacturing. So a lot of the macro that we talk about is enabling founders to build businesses with true strong moats and defensibility, which is very different from a commoditized manufacturing or a B2B trading platform, which does not have moats.
Got it. Clear. So it's clear that there are moats. It's just not there is a one size fits all kind of a thing. You need to take a step back. You need to identify the kind of business that you are in and then find the appropriate moat and then build capabilities for it. Got it. So that's clear. Let's probably move to the second one that you called out, which was ROSI. So if you can explain for our viewers, what is ROSI? Why is it important? And more importantly, how do moats play into those ROSI?
Got it. I think ROSI, when you look at a business, right, and especially in B2B, the single most important metric to see is ROSI or return on capital employed. And I'll give a very simple definition to it, which is very intuitive. So return on capital employed is what is the return or the profits you make on the capital that you've employed into the business. It's as simple as that. So let's take your 100 rupees, right? If you want a 4 rupee return, you would probably put that money in a savings bank account. You want 5, 6, 7, you move to fixed deposit. You want 8, 10, you take a little bit of risk with a few risky bonds. Anywhere between 10 to 15, you essentially put money in the share market. If you want more than 15% return on your money, that's when you go and do a business. Otherwise, why are you taking the risk of building a business, right? And return on capital employed is, if you invest 100 rupees, how much money can you get out of the business? So if you look at most companies out there and most traders or intermediaries out there, they will all operate between the 15 to 25% ROSI figure. Because if it's less than that, it does not make any sense to build a business. If it's more than that, then everybody would want to be in that business. And then sort of there will be competition and your ROSI will start reducing, right? So that's what is return on capital employed. Now the question as founders or as investors we need to think is on the new business that we are creating, why can we have better ROSI than the market? Can you generate 25, 30, 40% ROSI? And what that does is that makes a great company. Like if you invest 100 and if you can get 40 out of it, that's a great business. And that will also show in the next question on sort of cash flows. But sort of that's why ROSI is important.
Got it. But just before moving to cash flows, a natural question which comes up is at the early stage, most of the companies will not be profitable. Then how do you even go about calculating ROSI? Are there proxies that you can use? How do you then say whether it's a good company or not at that early stage when probably returns are just not there?
Which is fair. ROSI is obviously NOPAT by capital employed. But in early stages, you don't have operating profit, right? So the proxy that we use is take CM2, which is the net contribution margin, right? And so typically, if you look at capital investment in a B2B company, most of it typically is actually in working capital. Sometimes you will have capex, but in most marketplaces, you won't. In manufacturing setups, probably you will have some capex, right? And on trades, you will start making contribution margin very soon. If you're not CM2 profitable, anyways, you should not be doing a B2B business. The proxy that we take is your CM2 into number of times you rotate that capital, which means if you have a 2% CM2 and you have a 30 days of working capital, which means you invest 100 rupees and every 30 days you invest 100 rupees in working capital and every 30 days you make essentially 2 rupees, which means you rotate it 12 times a year, that's 24% ROSI. That's a proxy, and the proxy is because with scale in most B2B businesses, the CM2 and the EBITDA bridge actually shrinks, and in the initial stages you can take CM2 as a proxy. So if you are a 2% CM2 business, you should at least be thinking of rotating the capital 12 to 18 times. If you are a 5% CM2 business, then it's okay if you rotate it 6 times, which means you have a 60-day working capital cycle and you have a 30% plus ROSI. If you can get to 10% margin, you can still live with a much longer working capital cycle. But the proxy to look at an early stage is CM2 and number of times you are sort of turning the CM2.
Got it. So I think that is clear on how do we look at profitability. However, let's go probably one step deeper as well. And I'd heard this someplace wherein it kind of called out that revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, but cash is the king. And I truly believe that because the ultimate objective of any business should be to get positive operating cash flows that you can kind of get in the business. However, what we have seen is a large number of companies may be EBITDA positive, but similar to what you just called out, because of the working capital cycles, etc., there is no real cash coming into the company. So how do we look at it? What are the views around it?
So first I'll take a more macro view to this. See, the value of a business is discounted future cash flow. So businesses are valued on cash flows, not on revenue, not on EBITDA. So the sole purpose of a business is to throw cash, is to generate cash. And if you look at public markets, you will see that typically B2C companies have much better EBITDA multiples than B2B companies. Why? Because B2C companies convert their EBITDA to cash flow much better than most B2B companies do. So when somebody is valuing a company and looking at a company's cash flows, or sort of EBITDA and profit margins, they are thinking of two things. One, can this margin sustain over a period of time? And two, of that EBITDA that is generated, how much of that can be converted to cash flow? And if you can fix these two things, there's from an investor's mind, there's nothing called B2C or B2B. They are essentially underwriting the future cash flows of the company. Now, if you think about margins, any business that has moat over a period of time can defend margins, which is why moat becomes extremely important. If you are able to do something because of your moat that no one else can, then you will always enjoy a position to command your own sort of pricing, which will translate into your ability to defend your margins, which is predictability of margins or EBITDA over a period of time. Now, EBITDA to cash flow. So what happens is in a lot of software companies or B2C companies, they operate at negative working capital, which means I get paid today for the subscription of a year's fee over the next 12 months. So I get cash first and then the revenue is actually accounted for. In B2B, the revenue is accounted today, but you get cash 30 days, 60 days, 90 days later because of working capital. And that creates a stress where you're creating EBITDA, but you're not getting the cash, right? And second, if you have to grow, the more you grow, the more working capital grows. So a significant portion of the EBITDA has to grow into the working capital. Now, that's where ROCE becomes extremely important. What is ROCE? It is return on capital employed. So if you have 100 rupees, you make 20. Now, if you have to grow by 20%, you can invest this 20 back into the business and you grow by 20%. If you have to grow by 10%, you will keep a little bit of cash to yourself and it will cash flow will start showing. If you have to grow 40%, but your ROCE is 20, which means you will become negative cash flow. So although you are making money, you have to invest more money to grow than you are generating out of your core business. So if you have a very high ROCE company, even in B2B, if you can make 5-6% of EBITDA, if you can turn that, say 8 times a year, that's a 40% EBITDA se thoda katega no pat tak, but it's a 35-40% ROCE business, which means you can sustainably grow that business 40% year on year and still be sort of cash flow neutral or cash flow positive. So absolutely, B2B any company needs to generate cash flow in the future for it to become valuable. That cash flow needs to be defendable. So if you have high moats, then the cash flow becomes different, the margins become defendable. And if you have very strong ROCE, then you start generating cash out of it. So as a founder, think hard about where are my moats that can create defensibility of EBITDA and margin. What new value am I adding that I can have ROCE better than everyone else? And then automatically that ROCE will start translating into cash flow.
Got it. It's good to know that unlike market perception, if you have the correct set of moats, you can actually make a profitable and cash flow positive business in B2B as well. But let's just switch tracks for a bit. So we were talking about how do we build a big business? What are some of the key fundamentals that a good B2B business should have? But what we have seen is companies actually do quite well in going from the 0 to 1, 1 to 10 journey. But things start to break when they start expanding from the 10 to infinity journey. So what are some of those things that we have learned based on our experience with our portfolio companies, the market, etc. on things that actually break in the journeys for 10 to infinity, and what can founders do to kind of ensure that it doesn't break and they are able to scale up?
Sure. So in most companies, right, the places where we have seen things break are more on the balance sheet side of things and not the P&L side of things. If you are not making contribution margin profit in your 1 to 10 journey, you will anyways not make it in the 10 to infinity journey. But a lot of companies actually have a strong P&L. It breaks on the balance sheet because, as I mentioned, it's a heavy working capital business and doing collections is not easy. So having the right set of processes to enable collections happening on time and keeping a tight check on the balance sheet, I think that's one where we have seen things break a lot. Second, having the right processes and tech to manage people at scale. And that's where a lot of corporate governance issues come to, because you don't have the right monitoring and incentivizing mechanism for the entire organization. So A, building a very strong L-1 team with high integrity and capability, and then B, managing a very large sales force on the field team using tech and ensuring their productivity I think that's where a lot of companies break. So if I had to pick two, I think one would be ensuring that the balance sheet is fine, and two, managing people at scale and having the right set of processes. I think those are the two areas where we have seen companies break.
Got it. Let's deep dive into the last point that you made, especially around corporate governance and managing teams at scale, etc. And this is, of course, a very topical point at the point, right? I mean, there are multiple companies where corporate governance have been put into question, especially the level at which it should have been for companies of that size, etc. Right? So how do we look at corporate governance? Is it important at very early stages? How do we progress in corporate governance parlance also as we move forward in the journey for founders? So how does that happen? How do we view it?
Well, see, as Sanjeev Bikhchandani says, corporate governance starts at the mind of the founder. So that we obviously can't change, right? Where founders, so if a founder wants to do fraud, there will be fraud and you can't save it. But there are a lot of instances where the founder is well intentioned and they want to do the right things, but still corporate governance in the company breaks. And the, at least the way we have seen we can solve it in companies is A, for the founder to be cognizant of this fact and put right people and processes in place from day one to ensure that things are in place. Now, what do I mean by that? Having somebody to head finance very early on in your journey, getting a right strong CFO, reporting to the board at the right time, at the beginning of your 10 to infinity journey, having tech-led processes for underwriting, incentivizing people on collections, not on sales, and in general, having an ethos and culture in a company where anything that is unscrupulous is not tolerated, can be seeded from day one in the company. And I think once you get all the right people in place, put the right processes in place, as a board also, I think as investors also, it's our job and duty to ensure that some of these best practices are incorporated in the company. I think the probability and chances of sort of fraud and misreporting goes down over a period of time. For example, our best founders do internal audits of their company on their own. It's not an external audit, it's not a stat audit. It's an internal audit, which is a health check of the company that also informs the founders if something is broken, right? So getting all of these pieces in place, hire good FC, then CFO, ensure that there are right tech-enabled processes to monitor the business, incentivizing people on the right metrics, having internal audit to know about any issues before they actually come up. And both the founder and boards thinking about it, I think will ensure that even the edge cases where corporate governance is breaking because we were not aware of it, that stops happening.
Got it, clear. So essentially good intentions and having processes in place to get those early warning signals are the key to having good corporate governance. I think that's great. Just to wrap things up, and how do we now think of B2B investments? Are you planning on making more B2B investments in the next 6 months or the year to come?
If we were not planning to make more investments, we would have not have hired you. So as I mentioned in the beginning, we continue to be bullish. I think if I look at the run rate over the last 3-4 years, we have been consistently making 2 to 4 investments every year. In fact, in the first half of this year, we have already made 2 investments in B2B. So we continue to look to invest more and more in B2B. I think the slight changes, we have traditionally invested more in B2B marketplaces and distribution plays, which we will continue to do. But now we are increasingly seeing more opportunities in the production side of B2B, which is core manufacturing, say an ODM or EMS player, right, for electronics manufacturing, or in core agri-tech, where you essentially take a farm and significantly increase the yield or create a new form of seed that has much better yield than traditionally out there. So there are new pockets that we see. So if I look at B2B, right, on the first wave, we invested a lot in India distribution business, companies like Off Business and Farmart and Business. Then we said we'll invest in companies that take Indian products to the world, companies like Captain Fresh and Zimkart and Sourceways, etc. Now we'll continue to invest in both India and global distribution businesses, but the focus will also shift a little bit into investing in core businesses which manufacture or produce goods and have an IP which sort of differentiates them from every other product. I think rest of it, I think warrants a different podcast, but continue to be extremely bullish on B2B and look forward to making many more investments going forward.
Sure. Thanks. And that brings us to the end of our podcast. Thanks, Sudipto, for your invite and for your insights, and thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thank you.